All right, we came across this website, crackberry.com. It's for people who really love their blackberries or are addicted. Considering the name comes from, the smokable form of cocaine that produces a psychoactive high. The site does offer a 12-step program offering you to help step away from the device. Step one, admit we are powerless over our crackberries, that our lives have become unmanageable without the little gadgets, and that like Pavlovian dogs, we are slaved to its beeps, vibrations, buzzes, and rings. Now, if you need help for this, you can head to our blog. We'll link you through to Salvation. You can even use your BlackBerry to look it up, email it to your friends, post it on Facebook. Oh no, I believe I just was enabling you. I'm really sorry. Our next guest studies our electronically tethered lives. Clinical psychologist Sherry Turkle is a professor of social studies of science and technology at MIT and founder and director of MIT's Initiative on Technology and Self. Sherry, thank you so much for joining us on the Bryant-Bark Project.
My pleasure.
You gave a speech last weekend at Harvard's Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. One of our staff happened to be there, was quite impressed, came back and reported that you talked about cyber intimacies and cyber solitudes. Would you define each for us?
Well, I like to put them actually, I like to write it out, cyber intimacy slash cyber solitude.
Okay.
I think that one of the main stories today is that we're involved with technologies such as the BlackBerry, as you just mentioned, such as instant messaging, such as social networks, where we sometimes don't know if we're alone or if we're together. We feel connected, we feel engrossed, we spend 5 hours doing our email, we're talking to people all over the world, we get up and we look around and there's nobody home with us physically. We can live alone, we can be isolated, we can really be only connecting sometimes through the screen, or our most intense engagements are with our romantic partners in a virtual space who we never see otherwise.
You mean that I text ILY to my husband more than I
No,
get to say
I
it?
mean something else. I mean that you go on a place like Second Life, which is a virtual community. And you form a friendship, you form a relationship, and then in that virtual space, it's not uncommon that people who are involved with other people and have different lives or live in different parts of the world, actually marry, but in the confines of the virtual space, forming very close attachments that really matter to them, often without knowing if the person they're attached to is a 80-year-old man in a nursing home in Tampa or a 17-year-old, guy in Madison, Wisconsin, who's doing a college student. I mean, there's a since people many times online play characters, create avatars and create characters who they aren't necessarily, we form these connections. And I'm adding all of these connections kind of together, the avatars, the email, the instant messaging, which are different in many ways, but alike in one way that I think is very important, that the connections we make there, we don't always know how to take back to the rest of our lives, and they don't always sustain us in the rest of our lives. And so we live in this kind of on the border between a sense of intimacy and a sense of solitude.
You've edited two books, Evocative Objects, Things We Think With, and Falling for Science, Objects of the Mind. The essays explore objects as emotional and intellectual companions. Now, how is it that humans cognitively construct a relationship with an object, a thing, an email account?
We are built to do this. Our ability to take an object and infuse it with meaning, with caring, with even, love and attachment, and often a sense that it cares for you back, seems to be hardwired in us. And it's particularly true with the new kind of robotic pets. You see it very dramatically with the new kind of robotic pets that are on the market now. Remember the Aibo. I mean, if something looks at you, seems to track your motion in some way, and in the new robotic pets like Pleo, seems to recognize your voice or be able to follow your eye motion or know your name, which these new objects are programmed to do. It's like we are cheap dates. We believe that there is somebody home if an object can do these things.
Well, adults may be able to tell the difference, but I'm wondering about children.
Well, I have some concerns. I mean, I think that the best kind of play. I was actually, as I was answering your last question, I was thinking of the movie with Tom Hanks where he embodies a basketball, with all of the
Castaway, yes.
Yes, Castaway with all of the connectivity power of a person. That we really are built to be sociable, and when something sociable, authentically sociable, is not there, we need that company, we need that sense of an other, and we will create one out of the materials available. So moving on to kids, that ability is very, very powerful. I mean, when a kid takes a row of Barbie dolls and puts them in detention, what that child is doing is something very healthy, you know, makes a tea party and turns their back to the tea table. What that child is doing is very healthy. That child is doing unto the dolls what they somehow feel should be done to them. They've probably done something mm-hmm. wrong and need a little bit of punishment. The question that we face now, as we are giving children, you know, potentially a robot nanny, you know, or some kind of doll that has an agenda of its own and maybe doesn't want to be put into detention, has some intelligence of its own and wants to engage with the child on its own terms, is that we're not giving children that completely open space to do that kind of projective play.
Sherry Turkle is a professor of social studies and science and technology at MIT and founder and director of MIT's Initiative on Technology and Self. Sherry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, a closer look at Barack Obama's defining speech on race.
Part of China's crackdown includes blocking access to information about Tibet on the internet. Within China, fans of YouTube have suddenly found that they can't reach the site. Message board postings critical of the government have been taken down. NPR's Laura Seidel looks at how the Chinese are able to filter the web.
Here in the U.S., go to Google, then put Tibet and protests into the search engine. Up come dozens of stories and news videos about the recent unrest.
According to Students for a Free Tibet, about 2,000 protesters took to the streets earlier today. They were there for about 3 hours. They flew the Tibetan flag.
Put those same terms into a search engine in China.
And they won't get any results back. Their connection will be dropped.
Robert Ferris is a contributor to the Open Net Initiative, which studies internet filtering around the world. Ferris says China has the most sophisticated internet censoring system of any nation in the world.
They have very, very talented computer engineers that know how the internet worked, and this is a homegrown strategy for blocking internet content.
Cutting off searches is only part of a multi-pronged strategy the Chinese use, says Ferris. They also block specific internet sites like YouTube. When someone in China tries to go to YouTube.com, they get a message saying server not found. Sometimes, if they get on a blocked site, the connection will suddenly drop. The government has a much easier time with websites that are owned by Chinese companies.
The local Chinese video sharing sites will be regulated much more intensely than YouTube and will self-censor their material.
The Chinese branches of Yahoo and Google also self-censor. Chinese censors do sweeping searches of message boards, erasing postings critical of the government, says Vincent Brossel of Reporters Without Borders. But Brossel says the government won't erase hate speech against Tibetans.
When you attack and you ask to kill the Tibetan separatists, you have a way to get it posted.
The Chinese system for censoring the internet isn't perfect, but it's hard to get around, so most Chinese don't bother. Josh Rosenzweig is with the Dui Ha Foundation, which investigates human rights in China. He says the internet is simply part of China's increasingly affluent lifestyle.
The majority of Chinese people use the internet for entertainment, for study about other things that are not sensitive, for buying goods and services.
Rosenzweig says most Chinese people aren't motivated to jump through the government's hoops to get more political information, so they are sympathetic to the government's position on Tibet. And as an example, he points to a recent concert in China by the singer Bjork when she shouted "Free Tibet" from the stage. Her Chinese audience was insulted. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Thank you.
Now, a story that could have been little more than a cover piece for People or Us Weekly magazine has become a rallying cry for people who aren't rich and famous and who won't be booked on 60 Minutes to tell their story. Wrong doses of medicine given to patients. Actor Dennis Quaid spoke to CBS News at length about how his newborn twins almost bled to death late last year when they were given doses of the blood thinner heparin that were 1,000 times stronger than what was prescribed. The adult dose and the child's dose, well, they're apparently in almost identical vials with very similar colored blue labels. Here's Quaid.
These mistakes that occurred to us are not unique. And they're not unique even to Cedars. They happen in every hospital and every state in this country. And 100,000 people, what I've come to find out is 100,000 people a year are killed every year in hospitals by a medical mistake.
Quaid and his wife are not suing Cedars-Sinai Hospital for administering the wrong drug. They're actually suing the drug company that makes heparin. Well, why? Well, they say the company was negligent for not recalling old stock of the drug after the death of three infants in Indiana who mistakenly received adult doses as well. After that incident, drug manufacturer Baxter redesigned the drug labels but did not recall the old stock. Alan Veda is the executive vice president of the Nonprofit Institute for Safe Medication Practices, joining us on the line. Thanks for being with us today.
Yes, thank you for having me, Allison.
Now, the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine, they estimate that up to 98,000 people a year may die because of medical mistakes. How many of those actually involve human error? Is it all human error all the time?
It's from the report that you're citing, they were all due to human error. They cited around 98,000 deaths predicted a year, and around 7,000 of those would be due to medication errors.
So my question is, aren't there checks and balances, regulations, standards for double-checking dosages, and even types of medication?
Yes. As a patient safety advocate, the Institute has been promoting that for certain drugs, which we would call high alert drugs, and heparin would be one of those drugs. Some other drugs in those classes would be drugs such as opiates and diabetic drugs such as insulin and some cardiac drugs, that you do have special precautions in place. Some of those would be manual, which would be a double check that a second individual would make sure that the dose is correct, the drug is correct, if it's going on an IV pump, that the settings are correct. And some of those also would be trying to implement some technology. And many hospitals now have been putting in technology such as barcoding, so that you would actually scan the drug with a barcode scanner, and then you would either get an alert that it was the wrong drug, or it would say that it was the right drug.
Something that occurred to me when I was watching the story on 60 Minutes was, is it just one person that can cause a mistake, like what happened to the Quaids, or does there need to be a series of errors along the way?
The majority of errors that we get involved in or follow up on, there are many, many causes for them. There's many system breakdowns. In a case such as this, there was actually the wrong medication that was picked and was put into stock up on the nursing unit. Nurse came and actually picked up that wrong medication. So there's usually several breakdowns
along the way.
Also in this case too, just as it came out, there was a labeling problem in that the drugs looked similar. Now, they really weren't adult and child doses. They were actually just different strengths of the drug, because for this medication, it so happens the lesser strength that should have been used here is just used to keep a vein, just to keep the catheter open so that they could give IV fluids. But yet the drug is also available in a lot larger strength to actually treat problems such as blood clotting.
Sure. Now, Baxter's position was and is, you know, this is really up to the practitioners to read the labels. We have made them different. We have made them in the different dosages for the different reasons, which you just laid out. And healthcare pros need to read the labels. Do they have a point?
Well, you know, we hear this all the time, is that why didn't that nurse, physician, pharmacist just read the label, then everything would have been all right. But we know that as humans, sometimes we make mistakes. And it's been shown time and time again what we would call confirmation bias. And this is something in all industries that basically people will be familiar with either a product, a situation, the procedure, and that they'll actually confirm a wrong diagnosis in their mind. And but basically what they're doing is just saying this happens every day. You could take go for your milk for your coffee and someone else puts a different container there. You may actually look at it.
But obviously none of these health practitioners want for this to happen. What's going on in their professional sphere that makes it possible for them to make these kind of mistakes? Is it overcrowding? Is it overwork?
Well, there's usually a myriad of issues that go on. There are some work problems. There's some that basically you're taking care of a lot of patients. Patients in the hospital are a lot sicker. But there also are some safeguards that you could put into place. And oftentimes, I think the biggest thing with this is that trying to learn from mistakes. The same mistake did happen a year ago out in the Midwest.
Right.
And we published a lot on it. The FDA, the company, actually sent out letters on it.
So the bottom line is that needs to be action taken when the mistakes are identified. Alan Vede is the Executive Vice President of the Nonprofit Institute for Safe Medication Practices. Thanks for walking through the story with us, Alan.
Sure, thank you.
Coming up, the War in Iraq started 5 years ago. Tomorrow, there will be protests to mark the anniversary, just like last year and the year before. Not to be impolite, but do protests even matter anymore? That's next on the BPP.
The world has a new telescope, and it's a whopper. It has a modest name, the Large Binocular Telescope, but it can probe deeper into the cosmos than any instrument before it. It's twice as big as the next largest telescope on Earth, and it has 10 times the resolution of the Hubble Space Telescope. NPR's Ted Robbins visited the LBT high on a mountain in southern Arizona.
Like musicians, astronomers go to work when the sun sets. In this case, though, their instrument is inside a 17-story building on top of Mount Graham, and it weighs 580 tons. The instrument is so well-tuned that even when the massive dome slides open for the night, it's nearly silent.
And now the telescope is moving. It's rotating up.
Yeah, the only thing you hear is the elevator in the background.
You literally can hear nothing.
Pretty unremarkable.
Pretty unremarkable? Maybe to you.
As observatory manager, John Little has been watching construction here for more than a decade. But just a few weeks ago, the LBT began seeing with both its eyes. We're standing under them, two mirrors mounted in metal honeycombs, each nearly 28 feet in diameter. They can be used separately to photograph, say, the same object through red and blue portions of the spectrum. Or they can be calibrated together to form the equivalent of an enormous 56-foot telescope. We walk down a few levels to the control room.
Well, I'm Richard Pogge. I'm a professor of astronomy at The Ohio State University.
Pogge types in coordinates for this night's viewing. He and a half dozen others sit in a room filled with computer screens. There's a universe to look at, but time is limited. So scientists submit proposals for committees to choose from. One of the first for tonight, the Kuiper Belt on the edge of the solar system, about 2.7 billion miles from Earth.
This is an ostensibly blank part of the sky that's looking for Kuiper Belt objects, small ice balls out in the orbits between Neptune and Pluto and beyond.
How small? Well, Pluto is roughly 1,400 miles wide. The LBT can see ice balls in the same region that are just a couple of miles wide. The cameras take an exposure, a pretty long one, 5 minutes, and then on screen, the image is revealed. It looks like a field of stars. But take the same picture 6 nights in a row, and if you know what you're looking for, you can see the ice balls moving. In fact, with the data this telescope gathers, Richard Pogge says you can see a lot more.
how far away it is, what it is made of, how fast it's moving away from us, is it rotating, what is its mass, dot, dot, dot.
It's moving yearly, sidereally. Yes.
That's Peter Garnovich from Notre Dame University. He is helping focus the LBT on another object. No small task given the instrument's complexity. Garnovich is interested in a supernova that exploded a few nights earlier, a massive dying star collapsing into a black hole.
This star just happened to die, and its jet was pointed at us, and we can see it through most of the way across the universe.
The screen shows a large mass with a plume coming from it. Garnovich wants to learn how energy from the dying star decays over time. By looking at objects like this, halfway across the universe and back in time, these astronomers hope the LBT will answer some fundamental questions.
Where do we come from? How did we get here? Where are we going? Astronomy is one of the few ways we can answer that.
Plus, like playing music or making art, it's just plain fun, especially with a $120 million instrument.
It's kind of a privilege to be at a telescope doing this while other people are out, you know, working their day jobs.
Over the next few years, many more devices will be added to the Large Binocular Telescope to enhance its capabilities. It should be enough to keep astronomers working happily through the night for decades. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Tucson.
And you can see one of the first images from the Large Binocular Telescope at our website, npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The former CEO of Quest Communications has won a reprieve. An appeals court has overturned Joe Nachio's insider trading conviction. The court says a lower court judge improperly blocked a defense witness from testifying. And we have more this morning from Denver and NPR's Jeff Brady.
Nachio was sentenced to 6 years in prison in order to pay more than $70 million. So Monday's appeals court decision must have put him in a good mood. But University of Denver law professor Kevin O'Brien says federal prosecutors got some good news, too.
They won on all the other issues on appeal, and they have another bite at the apple, so to speak, because the Tenth Circuit specifically ruled that the government had sufficient evidence to warrant a conviction here.
Nachio was convicted last April of selling more than $100 million of Quest stock while knowing the company was in trouble. He's been out on bail. At the trial last year, there were many Quest retirees watching with interest. Some lost hundreds of thousands of dollars when the company's stock plunged from $40 to about $1 a share. Mimi Hull heads a group representing the retirees.
It's been a terribly, terribly slow wheels of justice process. You know, one thing we say is how many of us are going to be alive by the time this man is brought to justice.
In a written statement, the U.S. attorney in Denver called the appeals court decision a setback, not a defeat. He now must decide whether to ask the full Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals to examine the case or go ahead with a new trial. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
On Mondays, we look at technology, and today we zero in on spam. Those unwanted messages that fill up your email inbox with ads for hot stock tips and herbal remedies and whatever. They're now creeping into mobile phones. And this year, there's more mobile phone spam than ever before. Sarus Farivar reports.
Esten Bond is a 22-year-old web designer in Palo Alto, California. He and his friends text each other all the time. But some of his texts are spam, just like in his email. It's starting to bug him.
I mean, my phone is something that goes everywhere with me, so if someone sends me a text message, I'm generally expecting it to be something that requires my attention. Like, email doesn't require my attention as much. So when I'm like, oh, wait, I got a text message, and it interrupts whatever conversation I'm having, which it probably shouldn't.
The thing with mobile spam is that it feels more personal than email spam. Esten Bond loves texting because it's a quick and easy way to communicate.
I'll open it up, and I'll be like, oh, great, it's spam on my phone, as if I didn't have to deal with enough of this on my email. Now I have to deal with it on my phone as well.
Mobile spam isn't just annoying. It can get expensive. Most Americans pay per text, regardless of whether it's spam or real. That means if you get a spam text, you're likely paying a few cents before you check out that too-good-to-be-true offer. and the number of spam text messages is going up. Mark Donovan analyzes the mobile industry for M-Metrics.
In the month of January, about 12 million people received a text message from a company they hadn't given permission for. That's double the number who had received such kind of mobile spam in the last 12 months. And it is something that is affecting maybe 12 million people now, but it's on the rise at a faster rate than mobile marketing with text messages overall.
There are lots of people who sign up to get text messages from companies or organizations. For example, many political campaigns text their supporters. You can subscribe to, say, text messages from the Obama campaign. You'll get a text message at the end of every primary to tell you who won. It's not spam because you signed up to be part of the network. You can also sign up for weather and news alerts from other websites. Analysts like Richie Jennings of Ferris Research note that while spam messages are expected to increase, they represent a relatively small percentage of texts.
The sort of numbers we've been estimating for 2008 are something like 1.5 billion messages. But that's over the whole year, and of course that's spread over the large number of cell phone subscribers in the U.S.
1.5 billion spam text messages sounds like a lot, but Jennings estimates that this represents less than 1% of all texts sent in the U.S. Most mobile phone companies filter out spam. Sprint spokesperson Stephanie Walsh.
In an average 24-hour time period, literally millions of text messages are sent across our networks. And on average, roughly more than 65% of the total number of text messages sent over the Sprint nationwide network are identified and blocked by our filters as spam.
She added that Sprint has sent cease and desist letters to the worst offenders. A spokesperson for Verizon said that it has filed lawsuits against spammers who abuse its network. And a New Jersey state anti-mobile spam law went into effect this month, making it the first of its kind in the country. For NPR News, I'm Saruz Farivar.